morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Hirschman, is that right?
May it please the court. The district court below created a unusual and certainly unwanted scenario when it permitted a Mexican entity to come to the United States to get discovery not from a U.S. entity, not just documents located in the United States, but permitted this Mexican entity to come to the United States and ask the United States court to issue a subpoena to be served on a foreign entity in a foreign country to get documents located in a foreign country.
Counsel, may I ask you, you say in your reply brief that the sole issue on appeal is subject matter jurisdiction. Are you standing by that?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Neither party, but you in particular, do not cite this court's opinion in Republic of Ecuador versus Connor. Judge Jones wrote the opinion. Judge Smith was on the panel. And in that case, the court discusses jurisdiction under Section 1782. And it says that the court has jurisdiction over an application that alleges a non-frivolous claim for Section 1782 discovery. Did Grupo Mexico allege a non-frivolous claim? Regardless of whether it properly served it, carried it out, did it start by alleging a non-frivolous claim?
No, Your Honor. May I explain why?
Certainly.
Absolutely. Thank you. 1782 was designed so that a litigant or a tribunal in a foreign country could get discovery of documents or evidence located in the United States. What has happened here is not that. Grupo Mexico, the party seeking discovery, is not a party to the underlying action. SAS, the party from whom it's seeking discovery, is not a party to the underlying action. What happened was Grupo, a non-party, came to the United States and asked the United States court not for discovery located in the United States, which is what 1782 is limited to. And I say that because the U.S. Supreme Court has stated, quote, when a statute gives no clear indication of extraterritorial application, it has none. And it did that in the Morrison case, which we cite in our reply brief at 9. So what has happened here is that
Well, let me back up just a moment. I said I'd let you answer, but my understanding is the Grupo Mexico tried to effect service within Texas, could not get service, and then went to service from the Cayman Islands. So that would seem to suggest to me that it was a non-frivolous claim at the time it was filed, even if they then had to go to the Cayman Islands to get service.
I would respectfully submit that it's just the opposite, that it suggests that it is a frivolous claim, because the statute requires that the entity to be served be found in or resides in Texas. If they were unable to effectuate service, all that suggests is maybe they're not found in, maybe they don't do business here. Not that that...
One of the problems with your argument is that it really ends up turning subject matter jurisdiction on the merits. The problem with that premise is a court starts out with subject matter jurisdiction, ends up saying, well, you don't win on the merits, and therefore I never had subject matter jurisdiction, which is a very difficult proposition. In fact, Judge Jones wrote that these concepts of Article III jurisdiction are just, they're awkward when you're using something like 1782.
They're awkward when, in any extent, for instance, subject matter jurisdiction in a diversity case. You still have those factual inquiries of whether there is actual diversity and whether the jurisdictional minimum amount is met. So those are mixed questions of fact and law, which the courts have held are nonetheless subject matter questions. And if I could cite to you the cases we cite in our reply brief at pages 3 and 4, the Wagner case, the Canyon case, and the Montez case, that's in our reply brief at 3 and 4, all say, subject matter jurisdiction analysis includes issues of fact, discovery decisions, or magistrate decisions because they are intertwined. That is, you still have the issue of whether there's diversity. You still have if there's diversity jurisdiction. That's a factual inquiry that you have to decide. 1782 created a box, and that box was the court's authority. If the court stepped outside of that box, as it did in this case by extraterritorial discovery subpoenas, then it did not have the jurisdiction to do that. In addition, Your Honor, the subpoena itself was void because of it violated the rule. And the case law also says that a void subpoena cannot be enforced, and in fact, a court cannot even hear or grant a motion to compel. It cannot rule to amend.
Let me ask you a question, though. they at least alleged that SAS was found in the United States because it was at the Crescent Office Center near wherever Highland Recovery was, right? They at least alleged that.
Yes, but the allegation needs to be supported by some evidence.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, and then the court issued this ex parte order allowing them to attempt to serve their document request, right?
Correct.
I don't understand how they could do it ex parte, but it did. All right. And then SAS somehow wasn't around, despite evidently having at least a mailing address there. But Highland Recovery came in, represented by counsel, and objected to what the court was doing. SAS never did that until time to appeal to the magistrate, to the district court, right?
SAS filed a special appearance. Highland,
at what point?
Timely, within response to the motion to compel.
Exactly.
Well, Your Honor, the reason... And I'm sorry, I'm not sure what your point is.
Well, so the district court, as I understand it, the magistrate judge was ruling on the merits here, supposedly, and then the district court said SAS did not timely object to the proceedings here, right?
Kind of, Your Honor, if I may make a minor change. SAS did not respond to the subpoena within 14 days of the time it was reportedly served.
Okay.
However, SAS, the next thing that had, because remember, the initial proceeding was ex parte, so SAS couldn't respond to anything. Next thing that happens in the case is it gets served purportedly with a subpoena in the Caymans. It did not, within the time set forth in that subpoena, respond to say, bad subpoena, overbroad documents, however you would respond to a subpoena.
Right.
At most, that arguably waived the objections to the document requests, that they were overbroad or typical objections like that. However, that did not waive in any way, shape, or form the issue of, number one, subject matter jurisdiction, because that's unwaivable, and two, whether that subpoena can be enforced, whether the court had subject matter jurisdiction or any jurisdiction or the power to enforce that subpoena. When that motion to compel to enforce that subpoena was filed, SAS then timely filed a special appearance and said, no, the court does not have jurisdiction over us. It would be inappropriate to enforce that for a host of reasons.
That's not subject matter jurisdiction. That's personal jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I believe that is subject matter jurisdiction because it goes to, as the Carlsbad Court said, the U.S. Supreme Court said in 556, 635, 639, the subject matter jurisdiction includes the extent to which a court can rule. And this went to the issue of whether the court could rule on a subpoena that was void ab initio and that was done pursuant to a rule, 1782, which put a very small box around the court.
Well, sorry, it wasn't void ab initio because they alleged that SAS could be found in the U.S. Now, I'm not going to say that it was necessarily enforceable after that point, but at least on the face of the pleadings, they had you cite no case directly on point. Now, I'll agree with you. I'm not aware of a 1782 case that does this in the end. But suppose it had been British Petroleum. Suppose they got something from British Petroleum, but it in fact had to do with documents located in Scotland or Kuwait or something like that. What would BP do under similar circumstances?
Well, that, Your Honor, is, I'm sorry.
They'd come for, at least it would allege that BP is found within the U.S., which everybody knows it is.
That's the Sario case, Your Honor, that we cite in.
So the court would have subject matter jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
Number one, the service was defective and did not give the court subject matter jurisdiction because the service was extraterritorial. And because the Supreme Court says that in the absence of specific and clear indication of extraterritorial application, the statute has none. So because the service was void, there was no subject matter jurisdiction. Second, it doesn't matter whether we are found in Texas or not. And that's a very important point, Your Honor, and I would cite you to the case that we cite in our reply brief on page 7 and 8, the Sario case. In that case,
we're familiar with these cases. Let me just ask you, counsel, if the right allegations had been made, and then factually it turns out not that way, are you saying that that then voids or takes away the subject matter jurisdiction of the court?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I'm saying that does, but I'm also saying the fact that because there was the court purported to permit extraterritorial effect of this, that is, service in a foreign country, service on a foreign entity, and production of documents located in a foreign country, that violated the subject matter.
Let's take what you just said. Let's back up and change it a little bit. What if the court started out doing everything right? Service couldn't be affected. The applicant comes back to the court and says, now we want you to do all this stuff that you maintain is extraterritorial. In other words, the case starts out correct under your view and shifts to something that's not. Are you saying that the court had subject matter jurisdiction up to a point and then lost it because of what it attempted to do?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying the court never had subject matter jurisdiction.
Never did?
Correct.
Okay.
May I proceed?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, a couple of key points here. There is no indication on the face of 1782 of extraterritorial power. To the contrary, it says language such as found in or resides in. As a matter of law, the inquiry respectfully should stop there because if there's no indication on the face, a quote, clear indication, then it doesn't have any extraterritorial power, and the service of process and the request for documents and everything else that was done was void.
But so that just sort of begs the question of whether this entity is found in the district, isn't it?
Yes and no, but it doesn't matter. Even if the entity is found in the district, the Sario case says you still can't get documents from that entity via 1782 that are located in the Cayman Islands. So even if we're found in here, and there is no evidence to support that, 1782 clearly, and Sario is right on point, says you still can't get documents. Sario involved Chase in the Southern District of New York. Well, clearly Chase is in the Southern District, and the court said it doesn't matter if Chase is found in. The statute doesn't have any extraterritorial reach, therefore you can't get documents outside of the United States, which is exactly what they attempted to do here.
Are you saying, did I hear you just say there is absolutely no evidence of being found in the United States?
Your Honor, there are...
The record in this case?
The record is completely devoid of anything other than hearsay and conclusory evidence, and I could cite you to that. It's the Selzberg Declaration, which is found at the record at 235, which details little more than efforts to serve. And again, if they can't serve them, SAS here, to me, that suggests that they're not found here. And second, there's the Diaz affidavit, which on its face says it's information and belief, paragraph 7, and that's at the record at 1492. So what we had was an ex parte hearing based on one affidavit that said nothing more than efforts to serve, and then subsequent hearings that were based on a Diaz affidavit, which was said it was on information and belief. You also need to look at, Your Honor, the judicial interpretation of this, which is a very easy analysis because you had the drafter, Hans Smith, who said in the Sario case and also in the Godfrey case that 1782 has no extraterritorial effect. You have the legislative history, which says, quote, in obtaining oral and documentary evidence, it has to be, quote, in...
Let me just ask you a bottom line question here. Suppose we disagree with you that the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction from the inception. Have you therefore waived all your other arguments?
No, Your Honor. I still think we've not waived whether we can be found in. And I think that's, we have not waived for two reasons. Number one, I believe that's part and parcel of the subject matter jurisdiction inquiry, which cannot be waived. It's like determining whether there is met the jurisdictional minimum limit under diversity jurisdiction. It's a factual inquiry which cannot part of that's part and parcel of the underlying issue which can't be waived.
Is SAS found somewhere? You're not denying that they technically served SAS through some procedure in the Caymans, right?
Of course not, Your Honor. They're in the Caymans. Two, Your Honor, we timely responded to the motion to compel, which was the motion to enforce. And therefore, because of the time we responded to that, we have an opportunity to object to that and determine that we were found in or not found in.
All right, well, you have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Parenti.
May it please the court. The district court has the authority under Section 1782 to enforce a subpoena against a party residing or found in the district and subject to the district's to the court's jurisdiction. SAS's arguments fail for three reasons. One, the district court has subject matter jurisdiction. Two, service was proper. And three, the district court can enforce the subpoena in Dallas. As an initial matter, as Your Honors pointed out, the federal court's authority under Section 1782 is not jurisdictional in the sense that it does not involve a case or controversy between parties, but rather an interlocutory discovery application that's ancillary to a foreign proceeding, as this court pointed out in Republic of Ecuador versus Connor.
Counsel, I'm curious. I may have overlooked it, but I don't think you cited that case in your brief.
We did not cite that in our brief, and it simply, we were aware of it, but did not cite it. But it does, given the arguments that SAS has made on appeal, it really becomes clear that what this is an allegation that there was no subject matter jurisdiction, and that was a new argument they made for the first time on appeal. But Connor makes clear that if there's a facial claim under Section 1782, then the court has the power to interpret its own power under 1782 and to determine whether there is a 1782 claim. And here the court
did. So what's your position that we should really look at this like diversity? Yes, there can be an allegation of diversity, but if it appears at some point factually there's not, that ends it. That's what counsel opposite is arguing.
Well, if there, and Connor makes clear, and I think this is just very apropos here, if there's a facial allegation of jurisdiction under 1782, then that is it. That is the end of the inquiry on jurisdiction. And if there later becomes a problem, for example, with respect to whether SAS is found in the district, that goes to the merits.
Which they've waived, by the way. You agree with that?
Yes, they've waived any other challenge other than subject matter jurisdiction, and all of their arguments really go to personal jurisdiction, which is a challenge they waived below and again on appeal. And so this all comes down to whether there was subject matter jurisdiction. There was. It was an alleged that there was that the 1782 factors were satisfied. The magistrate found that. And in fact, there was no objection to those findings ever, and those findings are not on appeal here. So that is just water under the bridge, and the only question for the court is whether the district court abused its discretion in granting the motion to compel, and it did not for two reasons. And one is that the service was proper under the Hague Service Convention, and two, the district court can enforce the subpoena in Dallas. And Article 10C of the Hague Service Convention provides signatories the opportunity to serve judicial documents directly through competent persons.
You know, I'm not going to tell you I'm the world's expert on 1782, but I did do a bunch of research on that prior case, and I really don't see how the Hague Convention has anything to do with a 1782 subpoena, because that subpoena is solely for documents in the U.S. I mean, I agree with the Sario case, even though it's a district court, that it is not an authorization for American courts in service of foreign litigation to roam the world for documents of people or entities that just happen to be found in the U.S. That's grotesque.
That issue is actually premature in this case because we have no idea where the documents are found. In fact, there's been no allegation that they are solely found in the Cayman Islands.
Well, I thought your third point to us was that the subpoena could be enforced in Dallas.
It can. For all we know, the documents are found and available in Dallas.
Is there a person in Dallas?
There are people in Dallas working for SAS. They're shared employees between Highland and SAS, and they work in Dallas.
But you can't serve a subpoena on the milkman. I mean, you have to serve a subpoena on an employee of a certain level on the company, do you not?
Well, the subpoena was served properly, and the Hague Service Convention comes into play because it was just another tool that Grupo Mexico could use when all of its other attempts to serve were.
Tell me a case where the Hague Convention was used to serve a party in a 1782 proceeding?
We found no case exactly on point, but this is an unusual situation where we have a party that is operating out of offices in Dallas, and it has gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid service in Dallas. It has no registered agent for service of process in Texas, and after multiple, over a dozen failed attempts to serve, we served in the Cayman Islands using the Hague Service Convention, and that service, there was nothing improper about that. It gave them notice of the proceeding.
But the Hague Service is for litigation in the United States. It's for litigation, and 1782 is not litigation, which...
Well, actually, Your Honor, the Hague Service Convention applies whenever there's occasion to serve a judicial or extrajudicial document. It doesn't have to be related to litigation. And so we think it's proper to serve this subpoena that way. It gave notice, and regardless, all of the challenges, that would only implicate the court's personal jurisdiction. Whether it was improperly served goes to personal jurisdiction, not subject matter jurisdiction, and that challenge has been waived. That is no longer at issue. And so...
But Sario says you... Well, I see what you're... So you're saying... I still don't understand how you're even going to effectuate this on the basis of what you've done. Who are you going to put in jail if you can't find them?
Well, the CEO of SAS works out of Hyland's office and is their general counsel. And there's been never, SAS has never disputed that they have employees in Dallas and that they have operations in Dallas. That is just, that has never been challenged. And when the magistrate made the finding that SAS resides or is found in Dallas, SAS did not object. They could have. The time to have objected would have been when SAS got involved in the case, and they could have objected to that. In fact, when they finally did...
objected, right?
That doesn't... They didn't object to whether SAS was found in Dallas.
What's the basis of Hyland's objection?
They objected on the basis that the subpoena was overbroad, and objections to that effect. Now here, there's been...
The court fully sustained it, correct?
The court did not grant the motion to compel, but that is... We are revisiting that issue in the district court. We argued that more evidence was needed to show that Hyland had control over the documents, and we have a supplemental 1782 application that's pending currently in the district court, and so it remains to be seen what will happen with that.
Do we even have a final judgment here?
No. This is interlocutory in every sense of the word, and this is, there are proceedings that are awaiting for...
I'm saying, is this appeal interlocutory?
It is, and we filed a motion to dismiss that this was an interlocutory appeal. In some cases in 1782, the granting of the motion to, or denial of the motion to compel would be final, but here it is not, because there were two parties here, Hyland and SAS. There was no Rule 54B certification, no certification under 1292B, and so it was not final in the district court, unlike a situation if there was only one party. And so we think that dismissal is another alternative for this court on appeal, but we think on the merits that we win, because this very point that there is subject matter and jurisdiction in the district court, that is all that SAS is challenging, and it exists by virtue of the allegation.
Well, just suppose that you're wrong, and suppose that the proceeding was ill-starred from the very beginning, that SAS, although they may have waived the issue, found in the jurisdiction, that in fact they do not have any documents within the jurisdiction that are pertinent to your request, you would agree, would you not, that they cannot be compelled to produce documents from without the U.S.?
No, we don't agree, but I don't think that issue is presented for the court. Actually, the case law below is mixed on whether 1782 could reach documents outside of this jurisdiction, but regardless,
what case do you have that says that a U.S. court can compel the production of documents outside the U.S. solely in service of foreign litigation?
I apologize, I don't have the name.
I don't think I cited any. That's why I was asking.
This issue is purely hypothetical, however, because we have a party that is subject to personal jurisdiction in the United States. It does not, they are subject to the power of the court.
They don't have a registered agent. I don't see how they can be subject to personal jurisdiction. They might be, individuals might be subject. I don't see how the entity can be subject.
They have waived any challenge to personal jurisdiction.
No, they waived found in.
They actually waived a personal jurisdiction challenge. That was their only challenge below, was that the subpoena did not grant the court personal jurisdiction over them.
Well, and right.
And they've abandoned that now on appeal. They've said that was a mistake to characterize it as personal jurisdiction. Therefore, they've effectively conceded they are before the court. They're found in the district. They did not ever object to that finding. And in fact, when they finally objected to the motion, the order on the motion to compel, they stated in their objections that the parties dispute no material facts. That's found in the record on appeal at 537.
The material facts, as I understand it, are found in, and whether there was some kind of service effectuated in the Caymans, right? Those are the material facts.
They never challenge whether they reside or found in the district until their reply brief on appeal. And so they have accepted.
I understand that, but I'm saying that is what they've waived, and the only other possibility. It can be a matter of characterization. I really hesitate to, you know, if there were a serious problem about extraterritorial application, I really hate to put American courts in the position of saying, ha ha, you used the wrong procedural tactic, and therefore we get to do a fishing expedition extraterritorially.
And that's just, it is premature to address in this case whether this is that type of case. We don't have any statement by SAS below that these documents are only found in the Cayman Islands, and we have reason to believe they are in the U.S. They are accessible by their employees in the U.S., and it just strains credulity to think that in this day and age with electronic, with email and with electronic servers that these documents are not accessible in the United States. And so that there's been no finding that these are outside of the jurisdiction of the court, and SAS itself is before the court. It has employees who may be held in contempt for failure to abide by the order on the motion to compel.
Let's go back to this question of appellate jurisdiction just a minute, because I went back and looked to see what was said in the briefs, and I'll ask Mr. Hirschman about it on rebuttal. But, of course, his jurisdictional statement, as you know, claims appellate jurisdiction under 1291, and he says that Judge Fish issued a final memorandum opinion and order affirming an order granting Grupo Mexico a motion to compel against SAS, affirming that order that had been issued by the magistrate judge. So explain to us what there is about that order that would not be final and appealable under 1291?
Well, for one, it did not purport to be final. It simply denied the motion to compel as to Highland and granted it as to SAS. And
yeah, but isn't that what this dispute's all about?
This dispute is about the issue with SAS and the motion to compel as to SAS. Now, with respect to Highland, there was no final adjudication as to Highland, and at the hearing on the motion to compel, we discussed with the magistrate that we think there's need for more discovery to determine what the relationship is between the parties. And so there are two parties here, and so they needed
but,
to
but
have...
But that was denied, though, right? I mean, how is it, and I apologize for cutting you off, but I'm just trying to get to the heart of this. In what respect is that order, you may disagree with part of the disposition, but in what respect is it not a final disposition of the matters that were before the court?
Your Honor, the district court referred this case to the magistrate under 636
right.
B1A, which is to handle non-dispositive matters. The magistrate judge handled this as a non-dispositive matter and issued its ruling, which was not dispositive, except as to the motion to compel, as to SAS, and there was no indication at all that it was final.
But if it was a third-party witness to ordinary American litigation and the third party was ordered to compel, they'd be able to appeal interlocutorily.
With, if there were two, I think something more was needed other than just an order. They needed to get a Rule 54B certification that,
why?
That this, because there are two parties here, and one party's, the claims against one party were still, more was left
again,
to be done.
It's not litigation, it's discovery.
And the court, you know, in some cases, a 1782, a ruling on a 1782, there's no dispute that it's, that it's final and it, and it's subject to appeal. But here, this was a non-dispositive, at a non-dispositive stage, and SAS had waived its jurisdictional challenge. That's what the court held. It granted the motion to compel. And we had argued right at the motion to compel hearing that more needed to be done as to Highland. And that's exactly what we're doing now. There is a supplemental application.
So, at the point that the court entered the order that we are here to review, what is it specifically that remained, if anything, to be done in the district court?
To finally issue a final order. There was no final.
But I mean, what would the court do other than the final order that it had already issued that reviewed what the magistrate judge had done?
Well, it remained to be the magistrate needed to address our request for further discovery. And the magistrate,
I thought that was denied in the district judge's order.
Well, the district court, we didn't appeal on the holding on the Highland. So we did not object to the magistrate's order as to Highland. We argued that more needed to be done. We needed to establish a relationship between Highland and SAS to show that control, that Highland had control over these documents, which it had disclaimed. And so what remained to be done was really to flush out what the relationship was and to deal with discovery and the supplemental application that we subsequently filed on 1782, which seeks additional documentation. So this is a case where, because if there had been one party, I think it would have been clearer that this would have, this was a final ruling, but there were two parties and one party, there were still work that remained to be done in the court. And so that's an our alternative request for relief. I think on the merits we should win in that there was plainly subject matter jurisdiction and we have a facial allegation that we met the 1782 elements. Those were never objected to. SAS instead said there's no dispute as to the material facts, and therefore the only issue on appeal is did the district court abuse its discretion, and it did not. So that is what SAS is essentially asking for here is for the court to enter an advisory opinion based on hypothetical facts not before the court. And that is they're asking about what enforcement of a subpoena served abroad on a party not subject to personal jurisdiction, and that is not this case. Here, SAS is before the court. It's subject to personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction, and it may be held in contempt for its failure to abide by the motion to order on the motion to compel. And I think it's instructive to look at the, turning back to the issue of the Hague Service Convention, the Société Nationale Industrielle Aérospatiale case is very helpful because that case involved a discovery request to a French company over whom the court had personal jurisdiction. And the court held that the Hague Evidence Convention does not divest the district court of its authority to order discovery under the federal rules. And the same is true here. We have a party.
They're a party to litigation, right? They're not a third party in that case.
In that case, correct. But that's here we have a statute that provides, that gives.
That makes all the difference in the world because there you've got a case where the American courts have the authority to adjudicate a dispute centered in America. I mean, centered wherever it is, but litigable in America. And this is an entirely different situation.
It is a different situation. I just think it's instructive that their personal jurisdiction existed. And that's the same here. Whether or not this could be enforced in the Cayman Islands is premature. It's not at issue here. We have a party that's undisputedly in the Northern District of Texas. It's subject to personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, and enforcement can take place in Texas. And that is...
Yeah, and you don't... So you think the Kestrel case was wrong then, right? Seventh Circuit?
Is that the case involving discovery
Australia,
outside of this...
Kestrel, right, where the... parent in the U.S. was required to produce documents for Australian litigation that couldn't be compelled to be produced under Australian law.
Well, I think it's irrelevant whether it's right or wrong. I don't think it's right, but I don't think this court needs to reach that question.
Okay.
So thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, Mr. Hirschman.
Thank you, Your Honors.
If I may, I'd like to make one point and cite a case that has not been cited because one of your questions just led me to find it. The proposition is a district court can't enforce or even rule on the merits of a motion to compel if the subpoena was void. And the case I'm citing is Tattletale Portable Alarm Systems versus Calfee, C-A-L-F-E-E. It's a 2012 District, New Jersey case. That case involved a subpoena that was served by the wrong district.
Well, now you're saying the subpoena was void.
Correct.
Now, well, she says that you have, I mean, I am clear on this, you have waived the issue whether SAS was found in the district. You don't cite a single fact to contradict that. You never argued that. You've waived it. Have you waived whether there was personal jurisdiction?
May I address the first point?
Because it's not clear from the statute that found in and personal jurisdiction are the same, but, yep.
Well, I think the test for found in, I don't believe we've waived either, Your Honor, and I don't believe we waived either because, number one, I think it's a question of subject matter jurisdiction, which is unwaivable, and number two, SAS filed a special appearance in response to the motion to compel. You cannot, and the question is not whether we waived document being overbroad or objections to the subpoena, but the enforcement of that subpoena. And the case law I just cited says the court can't even rule on the merits if the subpoena was void. That subpoena was void because I think everyone agrees that 1782 has no extraterritorial permissions. So the fact that it was served in the Caymans, the fact that whether it was properly served or not.
What's your best case? You know, I challenged her to cite me a case where the Hague Convention was used to serve someone. I mean, arguably, it's not even necessary if you, in fact, waived the found-in issue. But if it is necessary, cite me a case that says they could not use the Hague Convention in service of 1782.
Can't, and respectfully, I don't have to, because 1782 didn't permit them to A, serve outside the United States, because that's extraterritorial. Look at 1783, for instance, which specifically says about how you serve a U.S. citizen outside the United States. Because 1782 doesn't have the, quote, clear indication of extraterritorial service, it doesn't exist. Supreme Court is clear on that. So it was served outside the United States, void, just because of that. It was served on a foreign entity outside the United States. Again, extraterritorial, void, just because of that. And third, it sought documents or purports to seek documents located in the Cayman Islands, void as simply because of that. So three aspects, any one of which voids that subpoena. Because the subpoena was void, the district court could not enforce or even rule on the merits of the motion to compel.
The problem with that argument is the district court didn't lose subject matter jurisdiction over the case. It may not have had the power to order to compel on that respect, but it didn't lose subject matter jurisdiction over the case.
I believe it already lost it, but even if it didn't, we did not waive that issue because we timely filed a special appearance and motion to object to that service when the motion to compel was filed.
Well, I thought we started, my very first question in the argument was, look at your reply brief, page one. You said subject matter jurisdiction is it.
And Your Honor, perhaps there's a miscommunication. I believe that is a question of subject matter jurisdiction. Okay. However, even if you conclude it's not a subject matter jurisdiction, we did not waive that issue because, set aside the fact you can't waive subject matter jurisdiction, we did not waive the issue of enforcement because the court could not enforce or even listen to a motion if the subpoena was void, and the subpoena was void for the three reasons I articulate, any one of those three reasons.
Or would you address the appellate jurisdictional question? You claim appellate jurisdiction under 1291. So tell us how it is, in your view, that the district court's order, the one that you're appealing from, is a final appealable order as to all issues and all parties.
Your Honor, you and Judge Jones did a better job than I could ever do. You both said, what else was there supposed to be done? This is not a litigation. This is not a discovery dispute in a lawsuit. This is a discovery case. The only issue to be resolved is, what are we supposed to, whether we were supposed to produce documents or not. The district court said, produce them.
Well, produce them as to one party and not as to the other. So I think Ms. Parenti claims that as to the party as to which it was denied, that there's still further proceedings to be done. Can
but
you explain
be,
to us
Honor,
why
that's... There's nothing left for us.
Well, but then that's a Rule 54 problem, if you're right about that, because you need a Rule 54 order for it to be appealable if you're appealing the order as to only one party.
But they didn't appeal the magistrate's order, so that's done too. There's nothing left. Now, the fact that they've served additional requests or they want to do something more is essentially a whole new case in my mind.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.